Hello, 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 and welcome to My Empty Hands, a podcast about the martial arts with a focus on Kenpo. As always, I am Reggie Darden, and I am quite overjoyed and excited and all kinds of other great words about my guest today, Mr. Brian Doucette, the host of the most excellent Everyday Martial Artist podcast. So, if you listen to one martial arts podcast this year, listen to his. If you listen to two, then throw mine in there as well. But yeah, I'm really, really excited. You're a dream guest. I'm going to elevate you to dream guest status, and I'm just excited for you to be on and tell your story of how you got into the martial arts, especially your journey in Kenpo. But I know that your primarily your core system is Taekwondo. But but yeah, we will kind of get into all of those things as we go along. I usually kind of give my background, but we're here for you, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that. I'll just say that at this point, I have advanced ranks in Kenpo and in Capoeira. I've also done some Taekwondo and some Hapkido. I've actually gotten back into Hapkido.
Nice.
And I've also recently started doing Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, so... I'm staying pretty busy these days, and just, you know, enjoying the journey, enjoying the training, and getting to talk to lots of wonderful people through the podcast here. So that's the Cliff Notes version of my story, and maybe we'll get into more as we go along. But yeah, how did the martial arts find you? Where did you get started? And we'll just kind of go from there.
Okay, so I grew up in the Midwest in a small town in Minnesota, and with not much to do, a population of about 7,000 people, and as we were talking before, in the winters, really cold. So a lot of time spent, you know, indoors watching TV, watching movies and stuff, playing the old, you know, original Atari back in the 80s. But watched a lot of, like, we had a Channel 9 that on Saturdays did their, you know, Kung Fu Theater. So watched a lot of the Bruce Lee stuff and the Jackie Chan stuff, and something I always loved. But, you know, as you know from hearing my story before, it was never something I thought I could do. I loved watching it, but I thought you had to be like the superhuman athlete or whatever to do martial arts. So I never even considered doing it myself. And that all changed in June of 1984. There were, you know, like I said, movies were a big part of it. I lived six blocks from the local movie theater. So even, you know, back then in the early 80s, you know, 6, 7 years old, 8 years old, 9 years old, 10 years old, parents would let me and friends walk to the movies alone and go see movies. So, I mean, I remember going to, I actually remember this kind of, you know, nothing to do with martial arts, but this was a single screen movie theater. So when it was a big movie, it was packed. And I can't remember how many people it held. They've since remodeled it. Now it's like three screens. But I remember going to like the premiere of Annie when it came out and Raiders of the Lost Ark. I remember both of those movies. I was standing by the front door of the theater, about 10 feet away from the front door, but I was at the end of the line. It went around the whole city block to go see those movies. So, like, movies were a big deal, and we used to love going to, you know, opening night was a big, and still, I love going to movies opening night. But in June of 84, this new movie that we've been hearing about came out called The Karate Kid. And, you know, any martial arts movie, you know, if it was one my parents would let me go to, I'd go see it. And back then, a lot of them, you couldn't. A lot of them were, you know, Chuck Norris, a lot of them were rated R and stuff, and I couldn't see them in theaters. But this one was geared towards kids. It was called The Karate Kid. So me and a couple friends went to it and just blown away by the movie. And as we were walking out of the theater, our local Tung Soo Do school, which is about a block from the movie theater, was actually in a dance school above our police station. They were standing in the lobby handing out free passes, this little yellow card. Said, you know, 30 free days of karate lessons. They still, back then with the marketing, they called everything karate because no one knew what Tung Soo Do was. No one knew what Taekwondo was. It was karate, of course. And once you got into it, you learned what it was. But yeah, that's kind of how it started. Yeah, that I think it was the opening night was on a Friday, and my first Tung Soo Do class was on a Monday night. And I remember walking the 5 blocks to the, you know, karate school in June of 84. And, you know, of course, we didn't have uniforms at first because we were brand new. They just said on the card, it said wear loose clothing. So I think I wore camouflage sweatpants and like a camouflage t-shirt. And the instructor for all the time I was there, his nickname for me was Camo. That was how I was known in class. Like, Camo, come over here. So that was kind of how I was known. But that's how it all started. My first instructor was Mr. Bill Nelson, who's now Master Bill Nelson. And his assistant was Mr. Tim Broda. But Bill was actually one of the first guests on my podcast as my first instructor. We're still friends, you know, over, you know, 40 years later. Obviously, I didn't stick with the style as long as I wanted to. My parents back then couldn't afford it. And, you know, before I got a paper out and stuff. And of course, you know, over the next few years, it was just watching movies. By then, it was martial arts magazines. I started buying every magazine I could, not just Black Belt, you know, Inside Kung Fu and a martial artist magazine, all these ones, and going to the library and just getting a ton of books and reading different martial arts books, reading about Bruce Lee and Chuck Norris. And then, of course, the 80s was huge for martial arts movies. After The Karate Kid kind of started that, then you started seeing Steven Seagal pop out and Jean-Claude Van Damme. And, of course, me and my friends went to every one of those movies, and I started getting books and magazines and researching all of those martial artists, too. So that's kind of how my journey started back in 1984. I only stayed in it. It was under a year. I think I got my first belt, which I believe was yellow belt, if I'm not mistaken, back then. But I still have my original white belt with a couple stripes on it. I don't know what happened to the yellow belt, but I do still have that original white belt from back then.
Yeah, very nice. I like you know, grew up watching the, we had the, you know, Black Belt Theater, Kung Fu Theater, mm-hmm. and yeah, I was just enamored by the Shaw Brothers movies and. Yes. 36 Chambers, that was mm-hmm. definitely one of my jams, and yeah, just couldn't wait to get involved with it. With me, I don't have any hard facts to confirm this, but when I went to my father to try and get into some sort of a training, he would not allow it. He says that he was a bodyguard for Muhammad Ali for a period of time, and he said that wow. Some of the other guys that he was working with, they were always talking about, you know, karate and martial arts were starting to gain popularity, and he said that the others were always talking about, oh well, I'm learning this karate thing and I can, you know, reach into a guy's chest and pull out his heart and, you know, give him the death touch and, you know, talking about all this killing situation. And so that gave him a bad taste in his mouth to martial arts. And so he would never let me join. And I just kept begging him. And it took about 15 years to finally wear him down before I could formally start training. But wow. Me and my best friend, we would just always watch all kinds of movies, and then came the fateful day when we saw The Perfect Weapon, and it was kind of all over from there, and we got all into that. So yeah, I can relate. I do like that you remember the first day and what you're wearing and everything. So all the details to that, I'm kind of surprised that I'm not that same way. I certainly remember the first few months, but the mm-hmm. exact details of that first day are still kind of cloudy to me. But
One other thing that jumps out, and I think back about this, and I brought it up to Bill when I was interviewing him, and he thought that was kind of funny, but we didn't, in class for kicking and punching, we didn't use like padded targets. We actually used X-ray paper. Them holding up X-ray paper, and that's what we were kicking to practice our, you know, our snapping kicks and our punches and stuff. And it was the only school I ever did that in. I said, it was a dance school. It was all hard floor, so of course, you know, a lot of falling and bruises and stuff. But yeah, I remember that. First time I used that. I remember using padded, I think was probably Shotokan. Might have been Shotokan, or it might not have actually been until I joined traditional Taekwondo, but I can't remember if we used them in Shotokan or not. I know we used, that was the first time we actually used padded gloves for sparring was in Shotokan.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was different too.
Right on, right on. I like it. So so after the Tangsudo, what was the next?
It was a couple, like I said, my parents couldn't afford it. And you know, by the time I actually got a job and stuff, obviously I had other interests as I was growing older, completely different side of my life. Around the same time as I saw Karate Kid, I also saw a movie called War Games. My uncle was the big movie buff in our family, and he was my godfather also. So, you know, he had like 1,000 Betamax movies. And, he'd invite me over and we watched movies on weekends. And he was the one who showed me War Games. And of course, my eyes lit up. I'm like, oh, I need to get a computer. And, you know, of course, so that was another part of my life that was really important. I fell in love with technology. And I remember, you know, getting a job, a paper route, and saving up and getting my first Commodore 64 computer back in the early 80s.
Nice.
Mid 80s. And so, it was, you know, I don't remember specific. I can't remember if the school. I know Bill ended up, I think, turned the school over to Tim, and Bill actually moved about 30 miles away. So it's like the original instructor I had wasn't there anymore, and I can't remember if maybe that's why. I do remember what it was. It was around the time Van Damme started making it big. It was when I could have actually afforded to pay for lessons myself. And I kind of fell in love with Van Damme and started doing research on Van Damme and found out that his first style was Shotokan. So I was determined, nope, this Tangsudo stuff, it was fun, but I want to do Shotokan. I want to be like Van Damme. So I started doing research and found out the closest Shotokan school is about 30 miles away. So I basically made plans. I think at the time I was probably 13 or 14. I said, I'm gonna basically save up for 2 years, and when I turn 16, I'm gonna start driving the 30 miles for Shotokan. So those few years, I still kept, you know, saving up money and doing the books, but I focused more on the technology side, and started dabbling a little bit with, which was ended up finally leading to my overall to the podcast. I started dealing with, kind of like mixing some audio and stuff on the Commodore 64. It had a, you know, back then, very, very old technology, but it had a cassette deck that would plug into it. And you could actually import music and mess with the audio. So I actually started editing music and editing audio sounds when I was, you know, probably 12 years old in like 1986, 1987. So that got into that. Also got into CB radios because of movies. Nice. So I got into using my voice and stuff and talking. And when I was a freshman in high school, that's actually when I was trying to find a better job. I was working for, so I started with a paper out and then moved to the newspaper that I delivered for. It hired me to come in one day a week and unload trucks. That was my first hourly job when I was 12, but I wanted to make more money. So I actually found a job at a local radio station when I was 15. So I started in radio when I was 15 and started doing that to make more money to save up. And it was, you know, going along, you know, 15 years old. And it was about a couple weeks before my 16th birthday when I knew I could get my license and start driving and stuff. And I'd already talked to the instructor, had went down to meet him, got my dad to drive me down there to meet him, said, I'm going to be joining. And I remember January 23rd, 1990, the day before my 16th birthday, high school gym class playing kickball. And I was on third base trying to get home. And the guy who was trying to get me out threw the ball too low. It hit my feet and tripped me. And my leg bent about 45 degrees the wrong direction and completely blew out my ACL, my lateral meniscus. And I was beyond pissed. I was just devastated because I knew that, first of all, there's no way I was going to get my driver's license the next day. There's no, and so it ended up being, I never had my knee completely rebuilt. They wanted to do that, but back then they wouldn't do it while you were still growing. They wanted, so I had supposed to wait until I was like 19 or 20. They're like, we're going to send you to rehab, and everything and start strengthening it. And you'll have to wear a knee brace. He's like, you won't be able to do martial arts at all. Hmm. And of course, in my mind, I'm like, you know, screw you, doc. Like,
exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. That's nice. And then the
nice thing about that rehab was it taught me how to work out. I'd never done weights and stuff before, but it sucked. I mean, it was painful getting that knee back in shape because, you know, that physical therapist, you know, like forcing my leg to go straight and forcing it to bend all the way. I mean, I had tears in my eyes many times, but over the next year, my leg got, you know, pretty strong. I still had to wear a knee brace. So it wasn't until was it end of my junior year, beginning of my senior year, before I was finally able, where my physical therapist said, I think you can do this martial arts thing, you know, because I kind of told him what it was about. It wasn't, you know, it was Shotokan, so it wasn't Taekwondo. So there wasn't a lot of the high jumping stuff, and it was a lot more traditional. And he's like, but you have to wear your knee brace. Mm-hmm. So I basically did that most of my senior year. Unfortunately, with my job at the radio station, I couldn't go all 3 days a week like I wanted to, but I was probably going 1 to 2 times a week. And it, again, only got to my first belt in there because I wasn't going to a lot of classes. But that instructor was Tim Keel from Central Minnesota Karate in St. Cloud. And the cool thing about him, the first time I met him, walking into his dojo, and I'll have to send you his picture, he looked like Chuck Norris. And, oh, nice. And that's not just like a general thing. I mean, legit, he could have been Chuck's twin brother. And oh, nice, and people nice. Don't believe me. And I show them the picture and they're like, oh my God. And he even got mistaken for Chuck. He told his class the story one time. He was down visiting his brother in like New Orleans or something like that. And I guess there was this big parade going on and Chuck Norris was actually in town. He was going to be like the MC of the parade. And my friend was walking outside of his brother's house and this car pulled over and this guy ran out. And ran up to him and he started, oh, sir, I'm so happy you're here. And I'm excited to work with you at the parade tomorrow and blah, 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 blah. And my instructor's just like, what the hell's going on? And the guy got back in his car and left. And his brother was just laughing. He's like, what was that? He goes, that's the mayor. He thought you were Chuck Norris. So yeah, that was, so it was always kind of cool. A lot of times I just show people my instructors in picture and be like, yeah, here's my instructor. They're like, you trained with Chuck Norris? I'm like, no, I trained with Tim. But yeah, that was, I loved it. That was the first time I ever used a Makiwara board, which was cool. I loved that. That was kind of fun to use that. And some of the patterns were very similar. You know, a lot of martial arts, they're basic patterns, at least the Japanese, the Korean ones are similar. So I picked it up fairly well. And the cool thing about that is I remember back the sparring gloves that we used were not the big padded ones like you have today. They were like, mm-hmm. almost like the white foam, like shin instep pads. A lot of styles use. It was basically that. So it was just that thin layer of foam, just covering your knuckles. And that was it. So it was, you know, for a 17, 18 year old, it was semi-hard contact sparring, which I enjoyed. And at one point I considered staying in that area just so I could keep training in Shotokan, but I also decided that I wanted to get out of my hometown. I didn't want to be stuck in that small of a town. That's the only reason I went to college. And I decided to go to college up near, and I purposely found a college that had a martial arts program. That was one of the reasons I picked it. I mean, also I knew the school because my sister went there and stuff. But mm-hmm. It's called Morehead State University in Morehead, Minnesota, right across the river from Fargo, North Dakota. And it was you could take Taekwondo for a credit. So I took other classes and Taekwondo. And then when I was up there, I found out from another student that there's three colleges up in that area, in the Fargo Morehead area, and they have back then they had a tri-college system, so you could take classes at other schools. Even though your main school was that one. And I found out that the local school about a mile away called Concordia College had an Aikido class. So I went and met that instructor and found out that he wasn't a black belt. He was second Q, and he basically did the class for himself. Mm-hmm. He wanted to keep training, so he was teaching other people. And it was 5 days a week, at Monday through Friday at 7 a.m. So, which, for a college student, getting up at 7 a.m. 5 days a week, not the easiest thing, but I did it for about 6 to 8 months and got up every morning, got thrown around. So, for about 6 to 8 months, I was doing that and Taekwondo at the same time. And to back up a little bit, I think it was 1990-91 when Perfect Weapon came out. Mm-hmm. When I saw that movie, I made the decision then that at some point I'm going to find a way to train in American Kenpo. And, of course, I looked. There was nothing in Minnesota at the time. Mm-hmm. So I decided I was going to go I'm going to go to California. I'm going to train with this Jeff Speakman. I'm going to find the guy from the movie and train with him. And of course, right after high school, I just couldn't afford it. I couldn't mm-hmm. afford to move to California and stuff. So but the plan was there. And I did the Aikido for about 6 months, 6-8 months. And then the Taekwondo was fun, but it was I found out later on it was a kind of a watered down version just because it was such a big class. The instructor just felt he couldn't teach everything that he did in his regular dojo to everyone. So, mm-hmm. like I said, I didn't find this out until years later. But The other thing was this instructor, and I know you probably know where this is going from here in my show, but he was very much into competition. That's all he cared about. He didn't care about safety. Like, he didn't provide safety gear for students. Like, if we weren't willing to buy it, it didn't matter. He got in trouble for this later on from the college because students were getting hurt in class and stuff and everything. But, and he was just, he was an asshole. I mean, yeah. To put it bluntly, he was not a nice guy. And I'm surprised I put up with him for 2 years. He drove me to the point that I hated martial arts. You know, after about 2 years, it was just under 2 years. Well, technically with him, so about 18 months with him. Because I trained with him the first 9 months of school, and then I went back home for the summer and actually went to a Taekwondo school about 30 miles away in Brainerd, Minnesota, with a gentleman named John Ingham, who's also a former guest. He was one of my first, I think, 30, 40 guests. And John, another one I'm still friends with to this day, and he was a great instructor. And at the time, they were connected in the same organization. The grandmaster who brought Taekwondo to Fargo, Grandmaster Mu Young Yun, who's now a 10th degree black belt, he's since retired. But he taught all these guys. He was their instructor. The Northwest Martial Arts Federation or Northwest Black Belt Federation that he founded and stuff. But kind of like the same thing that happened in Kenpo when Ed Parker died. Now, Master Yun didn't die. He just retired. But the fight for the power, the politics, that kind of ruined it. It tore it apart in the arts.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Exactly. It completely tore it apart. And because, like, the current instructor I'm with now, when Master Yun retired, he left my instructor his school, and he left my former instructor, my John Kreese guy, he left him as the head of the organization. And that guy threw a fit and basically, how can I be the head of the organization and not run the main school of the organization? And, my instructor it's like, I don't care. You can have it, and I'll just go off on my own. And pretty much left the organization. But yeah, like I said, it got to the point where I was going to quit martial arts and give it up. I hated it that much because of this instructor. And luckily, one of the other students in class saw that and approached me after class one time and said, you need to check with this other instructor in town. I think you'll really like him. And tracked him down. I'd met him at one demonstration one time, but didn't realize he was local. I saw him do a demonstration. He did this amazing break at this demonstration. I saw when Grandmaster Yun retired, all his masters did. And he did a triple front kick, double punch break, all in one jump. So five boards, one jump, broke all five. And it was amazing. So cool. I actually have it on video from his 5th degree black belt test But yeah, so I went over and met him and watched his class and joined the next day. The bad part was that I was taking the other Taekwondo class as a credit. So I couldn't just stop or I would have lost a credit and would affect my grades and stuff. So I didn't tell him I was switching. I kept going to both.
No.
So I just kind of quit caring at the one through the college. So, this was in like March of 94. So basically when it came time to test for my next belt in college, I had already got the belt with my other instructor. And I just pretty much, it was like a two or three classes before the semester ended and he found out and he tried failing me. And I went to the dean of the school or whatever, and they wouldn't let him. They're like, no, he's been to every class. He's done with you. It doesn't matter. You can't stop him from going to another school. Which back then a lot of people thought that, because when he found out I was taking Aikido, he had tried to stop me too. He basically forbid me from training. So yeah, that was my instructor, Jim Grimstead. I met in March of 94, and I've off and on through injuries and family stuff, I've been training with him for over 30 years now. So he's my traditional Taekwondo instructor and super good friend. And yeah, like I said, I've dabbled in many other styles since then, but he was my core one. And like you mentioned, the Kenpo thing in California, that was a hard decision because by then I had been with him 2 years and it was hard to decide to leave because I had planned on staying in California when I moved. I'd finally decided to go. Had actually got engaged before that, made the plan. So I was going to go out there, get established, get a job, potentially open a school and start teaching or whatever. And then after we got married, my wife would join me and come out there. And so, yeah, I moved out there. And at the time, in summer of 96, Jeff Speakman had a school in Victorville, California, and had chatted with him, you know, 6-8 months before and said, hey, I'm going to move out there and blah, 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 blah. And of course, by the time I got there, he had moved to another location. I had already got a job secured and everything. He had moved up in the mountains closer to Lake Arrowhead and left that school to two of his students, Jim and Deanna Diggs. So, unfortunately, with my job, I couldn't train full-time with Jeff. So, you know, I went up to his school a few times here and there, but then I had most of my training with the Jim and Deanna Diggs. And then when I got a new job closer to Los Angeles, I also did training with Larry Tatum, too. So it was kind of the three-way training there. And I was out there for about a year. Yeah, Kenpo, I remember originally reading about it just in Black Belt Magazine. Didn't know much about it. Remember seeing the When Kenpo Strikes video advertisements for the videos, but I couldn't afford to buy the video, so I never knew what it was. Until Perfect Weapon, I didn't know what it was. I read about this, you know, this amazing self-defense system and everything, and you know, seeing that on screen for the first time just blew me away. I'm like, I have to learn that style. I really do.
Yeah, no, so. I can totally relate. Me and my buddies watched Perfect Weapon. We just were completely enamored, and if it wouldn't, had I not noticed that the sign on the school said Kenpo, we wouldn't have known what that was. But I remember my friend looking at me like, oh man, like what is this? And it's like, oh, well, I remember in the beginning there was a sign that said Kenpo. So I think that's what this is. So we need to get involved. And we found a school, and he got to join, I guess, about maybe 6 months, a year before I got the okay to join.
Okay.
But I was at the school from open to close. I was watching every class. I was there every single day. And so by the time I finally got to officially sign up, I kind of already knew the Orange Belt curriculum fairly well. And now there's I think the statute of limitations has passed, but my friend was sneaking me off some information when he wasn't in class. So I got a little informal training before I officially got started. But
well, I do remember at the very end of the movie, right before the credits start, the it comes up and it says, "This film is dedicated to Ed Parker and the spirit of Kenpo Karate." That's what I remember seeing that. And as soon as I'm like, "Oh, Ed Parker, I know that name," because I had read about him so many times. So yeah, then that's when I made the connection that it was the same thing. You know, because in the movie, it wasn't American Kenpo. Mm-hmm. It was Kenpo. they kind of leaned into more of the traditional side of Kenpo instead of straight out saying it was American Kenpo. And I should have asked Jeff that when I interviewed him. I never thought about asking him why that was, why it didn't say American Kenpo in the movie. But I'll have to maybe message him later and ask him. I'm kind of curious about that. But
yeah, kind of my little, I don't know, I guess, insight to that. So in the school that I started at, we followed, and it was essentially under the Tracy's nice. Lineage.
Okay.
However, we didn't describe it as that. We we didn't call it Tracy's Karate. We just called it Kenpo.
Okay.
But kind of, I guess, funny is that so. My instructor is a man by the name of Dick Willett, and he trained under the Tracy's, and he got his black belt under the Tracy's. But in that particular lineage, we actually called it American Kenpo. Well, or I should say it did become known as American Kenpo. However, that naming of it came at the same time that Ed Parker started calling it American Kenpo.
Okay.
And so there, I'm forgetting who it was that I was talking to, but they were mentioning being at a tournament, and talking with Ed Parker, and I was like, oh, well, like, we got this, we were doing this American Kenpo thing. And Ed Parker was like, oh, well, like, I'm calling my thing American Kenpo. And it's like, oh, well, you know, we didn't know, you know, obviously the internet and everything were not big back then. So,
yeah,
nobody, you kind of knew what each other were doing. And, so there was a kind of, there wasn't a fight or anything about it, but it was just like, oh, well, we're both using kind of the same name. And, since then, I guess my kind of association or that lineage is now the Southern, you know, Southern California or California Kenpo, and don't really go by the American Kenpo, but
that was
kind of funny that it's like, oh, well, we kind of came up with the name at the same time. And
nice.
So that's my understanding of it
anyway. Okay. But, yeah, it's one of, you know, one of the biggest regrets is I never got to do more with that. Cause I mean, I have all of Larry Tatum training videos. I have the When Kenpo Strikes. I have his curriculum videos, but I've never found a friend that wanted to learn it enough to train with me consistently. Mm-hmm. So it's like, you can only do so much on yourself, you know, with video. You have to have a good training partner, unfortunately.
Kind of the a little bit of the situation that I'm in. So unfortunately, the school that I'm training at, or the instructor that I'm training with, had to close his school in December. Okay. And so we've been just kind of doing private lessons so far.
That's cool.
And but I definitely need the body time.
Yeah. Makes a difference. It really does. And I'm kind of like you. You were talking about how you were there open to close, you know, back, you know, I started with him in 94, and by March of 94, and by the end of 94, early 95, I had made enough friends there and found out one of the friends who was one of my best friends now, you know, the instructor actually gave him a key so he could stay late. He could come in early, whatever. And he's like, do you ever want to come in? I'm like, yeah, here's my number. And yeah, we were, so he had class at the time 6 days a week. And, you know, most nights we were there, we'd stay 1 to 2 hours after class if we weren't working. And then, you know, we had a Saturday class in the morning, plus we had a Saturday open gym, and then we'd stay another 4 or 5 hours after, plus we'd go in on. There was a time for probably about 2 to 3 years where I was there 7 days a week, a minimum of 5 to 6 hours a day. Mm. And I loved it. As far as my martial arts journey, those couple years were some of the best of my life. We had so much fun. There'd be a group of, at any given time when class was done, there'd be anywhere from 2 to 6 or 7 of us just staying after and working on different techniques. Or we'd, you know, we'd see something in a movie that we liked and we'd go and try to perfect that, or we'd just work on sparring techniques or just our regular techniques, getting ready for belt tests and stuff. And it was so much fun. Yeah, it's so much fun. And I still keep in contact with a few of those guys, and I've tried to get some of them, hey, you want to go back? Actually, the last time I re-injured my knee, the gentleman who, if I do decide to ever get that completely rebuilt, the orthopedic surgeon who's doing it is one of those guys who came with us on the weekends. Oh, he was one of the black belts back then that we were always training with. So he knows what I've done and what I went through and stuff. And yeah, like I said, moving back was hard, but yeah, at the time my wife, her fiance, the few times she came to visit, she hated California. She's like, I will not live here. It's too busy, too many people, too whatever. She did not like it. And she's like, if we're going to get married, you have to move back. So that ended my Kenpo journey there, unfortunately.
So you moved specifically to California because of Kenpo? It wasn't that you already were looking at another job or something?
At the time I was working for Walmart, and I knew I could transfer to a Walmart.
Okay.
No, the only reason I went was for Kenpo. That was the whole sole reason. I mean, at the time I didn't really know. When I made the plans, I didn't really know anyone out there. By the time I moved out there, I had one or two friends that had since moved out there, so I knew some people and stuff like that. But yeah, the whole reason was Kenpo. It's because of the back. I don't think there might have been a Kenpo school in Minneapolis at the time, but if there was, I couldn't find it. Not that I, at least it wasn't, you know, the Parker lineage that which I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. So
gotcha.
No, it was all about that. I mean, if you know, if I would have known if that Jeff was going to move his school, I would have made different plans or something. You know, it went a different direction. Who knows? But it was nice. Like I said, I got to train with him. I got to train with Larry. Hold on one sec. Hey.
No problem.
Sorry about that. Dog just freaked out.
Oh, sorry. no problem. Yeah. I've got a couple of dogs, and they usually like to chime in when I'm recording, and it's like,
I think he heard a noise upstairs, so he decided he's like our huge dangerous 17-pound watchdog. So he has to, you know, show his dominance when he hears a sound or something like that.
Oh, but, yeah.
No, the whole reason was American Kenpo. That was it. I mean, that was why I moved. And honestly, like my current instructor that I'm with now, that I've been with for 30 years, I've had a few other options to move to other areas. And those are ones like, you know, my wife, I don't think she would move, mm-hmm. but it's one of the main reasons I've stayed here is to stay with that same instructor. It's like as any martial artist knows, who's been doing it for a long time, if you find a good instructor, you stick with it. I mean, great instructors are hard to find. They really, there's a lot of good instructors. Great instructors are hard to find. I'd still love to learn American Kenpo. You know, at one point I remember Larry Tatum told me he had a black belt up in Winnipeg, which is about 3 hours from here, I think, straight north. Mm-hmm. And I remember talking to him a few times through email and trying to convince him, like, hey, if you'd ever want to drive down here, I'd, you know, pay you, you can crash at my house and stuff. And it never worked out with his work schedule and stuff. And at one point I found a local instructor who started advertising he was Kenpo, and went and watched a few like seminars and stuff, and it didn't look familiar to me. It didn't seem right. And went to a demonstration he did and videotaped it, and actually went up there and took part. And I remember I sent the video to Larry Tatum. I said, hey, I found this local guy. He claims like a sixth degree in Kenpo, and sent Larry the video. And Larry responded back to me like an hour later, you know, excuse my language, but he's like, I don't know what the fuck that guy's doing, but it's not Kenpo. So, super nice guy. I just decided not to train with him. Mm-hmm. You know, like I said, super nice guy. If I'm going to train with someone, I'm going to confirm with either Jeff or Larry that they're legit before I do it.
Yeah.
If I'm going to learn Kenpo, I'm going to learn it the right way. So,
yeah, no, I can definitely relate to that. So my current instructor, he actually got his third and fourth from Larry Tatum.
Nice.
Before I started training with him, I was actually checking out some of the other Kenpo. There are a few Kenpo schools in this area, and I'm not going to name names on the air, but mm-hmm. One of the schools that I did go to, it was unbelievable what I was seeing. The instructor himself had some talent, mm-hmm. but the things that I was seeing going on with their students was just appalling. I mean,
yeah.
One of the students, they were all getting ready to test for upper belts. Most in the black belt level, and one of the students spent the whole time fighting with tying their belt properly.
Oh wow!
Students that were getting ready to test, I was just seeing a whole lot of things that I just couldn't believe, especially for upper level belts.
Yeah.
And so I decided, this is not the school for me. So I'm glad that I found my current instructor, and it was quite a blow when he had to close his doors. And
yeah,
I was investigating some of the other schools, but kind of like in your situation, the other schools are a little bit too much of a trek for me, as far as going in more than once a week. You know, I need to get at least, you know, 2-3 times a week, and that's the journey's a little bit too far to do that. So
See, I'm lucky within the Fargo-Moorhead and surrounding area I live in. There's probably 30 plus martial arts schools. So that's the one nice thing too about living here. Other than the brutal winters that suck, but I've been able to at least sample so many other styles. That we have locally and over the years. I mean, some aren't open anymore, and some still are. But we've had MMA, boxing. We've had kung fu. We've had there was a Shaolin Kempo instructor, Shotokan, Taekwondo. Actually, surprising, no Tung Sudo school up here. It was kind of really surprising. That's one of the few that has, but Hapkido, Aikido, and many different styles, which has been kind of fun to sample those. And a lot of them that are open minded will invite them in and do trainings with them and stuff and things like that. So that bit, like I said, I always kind of stuck with my core instructor since then. After I moved back here and stuff, and stuck with him and started training with him full time again. But I've always been one of the open-minded people to always, look at other styles and welcome. Like my instructor's one where if a new school, if he hears a new instructor's coming to town and looking for a place, that's when the Hapkido school first came to town, he was looking for a place to open a school. So my instructor reached out and said, hey, I'll sublet you, two nights a week if you want to teach. And that's how our local Hapkido school started. Now they're off on their own. He now sublets our local judo club three nights a week. They've been with him for over a decade now in that place and things like that. So he's a very open-minded instructor. He encourages, open-mindedness and other styles. And we were one of the first martial arts schools in the area back in the 90s to start doing grappling and ground fighting. Right around the time the UFC came out, when no one else was doing that and people weren't doing the cross training and stuff, we started doing that in 94, 95. So yeah, I'm very lucky. great instructor to have and be with. And I've never gone since then full bore into another style. It's always been more dabbling, and stuff. And, a few weeks here, a weekend seminar there, some private stuff with friends who do the training. A lot of the friends who still do Hapkido. I'm really good friends with the Hapkido instructor before he moved away. He was another one of my guests. Did some training with him and stuff, and the judo school, the Aikido school, the jiu-jitsu school. So it's a lot of them, like I said, a lot of them are very cool, very open-minded. I'm really good friends with a local boxing instructor, and we did some training for 6 months in boxing, and I taught him how to kick. He taught me boxing punches. I'd done boxing a little bit when I was a kid, but not that much. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of fun. This was, if you're a boxing fan, this guy was, had some pretty well-known students, and had a Virgil Hill. He was one of Hill's original trainers. So oh, nice. I got to train with one of Virgil Hill's trainers for 6 months, which was kind of cool. So
very nice.
Yeah. And then also when I moved back from California, the other thing that I got back into, because I hadn't done it in about 3 years, was radio. When I got done with college, I couldn't find a radio job. But when I got back from California, that was the first thing I found. And around 97, so around 98, I had actually pitched the idea of a martial arts talk show to the radio station. And I'm like, hey, this is pretty popular, this UFC thing kind of getting big and everything, and there's a lot of local instructors, and I do it myself, and they wouldn't let me do it. they didn't think it would work, and every station I worked at after that, between 97 and probably 2011, every station I worked at, I pitched the idea of a martial arts talk show, and none of them thought it would work. They didn't think it would, people would listen. They didn't think it was something people cared about. And so I kept doing my training, kept working in radio, and then it was 10 years later when I finally launched the podcast. So
that makes me think about any time a martial arts TV show would come on the air, and I'd see it and I'd get all excited. Ooh, martial arts TV show. And then my next thought would be, well, this is not going to make it past one season.
Yeah, I know.
Maybe great, but just there's never enough love for martial arts shows. And
with the exception of Walker, Texas Ranger and Highlander, not many have made it. I mean, Cobra Kai, obviously now, but I think Into the Badlands with three seasons. Mm-hmm. But the shows like that, Martial Law back in the 90s was two seasons. I think Street Justice did one or two seasons. I mean, most of them were three seasons or less. And some of those were really good. I mean, some of them you go back and watch them now, like The Master. Mm-hmm. Man, that was cheesy. It was really cheesy. Yeah. But when you were 10 years old, that was amazing. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, mm-hmm. And a lot of it's marketing. Because, I mean, obviously, martial arts movies do great. So, you know, in Cobra Kai, that obviously has the nostalgia going for it. That's one reason it's been so successful. It's because of the Karate Kid movies, but
I think the writing on it though is really good and really kind of fleshes out the characters, especially for me. Johnny Lawrence is kind of my spirit animal, and nice. I love the way that he's kind of stuck in the 80s and I just laugh so hard when he's just kind of stuck in this old
time
ways
loop or something. Yeah. William Zabka is a phenomenal actor. This is definitely one of his best characters. I mean, I'm loving it. I mean, I didn't think I would. I watched it thinking I'd quit after one episode, and next thing you know, I watched every episode in like 4 hours or whatever, whenever that first season came out. So I was hooked pretty quick on, but
I actually just finished rewatching it, the whole thing. A few weeks ago, I had somebody that was on the show as an extra, a few weeks back, and so nice. I was like, oh well, like I need to make sure that I rewatch that, and then also had a chance to have Daryl Vidal on, so
yep,
that was nice as well, so.
Yeah, Daryl's cool. Yep. Yeah, I've been lucky. I've had like 5 or 6 people connected to the Karate Kid universe now, 3 of them that have been on Cobra Kai. So fun to talk to and reminisce and stuff. And definitely a good time to be a host of a martial arts podcast. That's for sure.
Oh, yeah. No, that's definitely one of the things that I've been surprised about doing this show. When I started, I figured, okay, well, I'm going to get some. Of course, I'm going to try and get my teachers on, and I'll get some, non-notable people, and maybe I'll get lucky and somebody, big time will be on, and eventually I'll get some more big name guests. But when I put it out there that I was going to start doing this, some of the first, probably the first 5 to 10 people that agreed to be on are notable names in the world of Kenpo. And
nice.
I was like, holy crap, this is, there's no way this is going to happen. And, everybody's been really, really, fantastic. I've only had, two no's as far as, people that I've asked. One of them was very, very nice. They were just, I'm just not interested in doing it. No, nothing with that. And then, the other person was still very nice, but, a little less thrilled. Actually, they had agreed to be on originally, but, they saw a post that I made on Facebook, and they decided, I'm not going to do that now.
Had it happens. Two no's in over 200 episodes. So, sometimes you get pretty lucky and you never know. I mean, and the thing is the big names are great, but some of my best episodes and some of the highest rated for my listeners have been the unknowns.
Oh yeah,
Instructors down the street and stuff and things like that. So it's, like I said, the big names are good, but if you can't get the big names, don't worry, because it's the real people, the stories that people really want to hear. I mean, I think three of my most popular episodes are people that no one's ever heard of. So.
Yeah, that's my big thing is that I love to hear the stories. I mean, it was great to get to interview, Jeff Speakman and Lee Wedlake, and I've got some other people that are on the list that have agreed to be on. We just got to get some schedule in there. Mr. Larry Tatum, I'm sorry, I'm going to call you out here, but he's agreed to be on. We just haven't got him scheduled yet, but
nice.
Yeah, I've just been kind of blown away by some of the people that I've had on, but I just love hearing the stories, and so many of the stories of how people get involved or make it their life. I've been surprised by how many people have made the martial arts their life, and they either weren't even going to be a part of it, or they were just gonna. They got, you know, drug to a class, and then the person that drug them to the class stopped training, but they kept with it, and I've just been blown away by how many of those kind of stories have that people have, and I just love it.
Yeah. Oh, I completely agree, and like I said, that's why those, you know, because a lot of the big name people, most people have already heard their stories.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why it's the unknown ones that are getting super, super popular. I mean, I've had, you know, one of my favorite ones is my episode 120, a local instructor, a Shoshu instructor named Alexis. And she didn't even want to come on. She was like, oh, no, no one, I've never done that before, and no one cares about my story. You know, and she was so fun to talk to. I had so many compliments. Like, I just loved her personality and such a cool story, and people just loved her. Mm-hmm. And when I told her that, her face just lit up. So she was so happy, and it was like, yeah, it was such a fun episode. And I've had so many of those, like that. Why would anyone care about me? And I just had another person I reached out to, and he's like, I don't have an interesting story. No one's gonna care. And I'm trying to convince them, like, hey, listen to these five episodes. Mm-hmm. You've never heard of these people, but listen to their stories. I trust me. Just let's give it a shot. So
yeah. No, I agree. I love the feedback, and I've just been surprised, and you know, one of the our mutual guest, Sensei Duval Hamilton.
Mm-hmm.
When I had him, or when I reached out to him, and he was. Yeah, he was excited to be on, and since then I've been to his school a few times, and some of his people have kind of come up to me, and they're like, "Oh, well, like, you know, we listened to the episode, and we're so happy that he got to do it, and you know, getting that name out there, and it wasn't just because." He was there. He's their teacher. It was good to just hear the story, even if they didn't know him. So,
yep,
been pretty excited about how that's all.
The cool thing with having a show like I have and having a show like you have is that, you know, 99% of your episodes aren't date sensitive. You're not doing it to like promote an upcoming movie or something like that. So, 99% of your episodes. You know, if you're still doing this like me 3, 4, 5 years later, you know, I get listeners all the time where like, I just found your podcast 3 months ago and I've listened to all 200 episodes in the last 3 months. Like, people will go back and listen because it's not, you know, like a lot of podcasts, it's focusing on like current events and stuff. So mm-hmm. if people listen to it a month after it came out, it no longer makes sense and people don't care, where these are, you know, these are stories. People are going to care. And the other thing, you know, like I've mentioned with a few of my guests, is I've had, you know, 3 guests now that I've had pass away. And, you know, for at least one of those, I was their last interview before they passed away. And it's like, some of these people, their stories need to be told. You know, exactly, these people who have maybe they've never written a book, or they've never done an in-depth interview, or only interviews on paper. You know, they've mm-hmm. never been recorded and stuff. So it's like, you know, having these out there and archived for future generations, hopefully, to find 20 years from now and be like, oh, mm-hmm. this was my grandmaster, and oh wow, we just found an interview from him from 2024. I mean, how cool is that? So it's definitely important to what we're doing, and so hopefully, you know, that's why I love all martial arts podcasts. I know, and you know, like, if this was radio, we wouldn't be doing this. We'd be competing. You know, we're not going to be interviewing each other and helping each other and stuff. And because it's like, okay, Thursday nights at 4 p.m. on 92.7, both, you know, these, and 98.6, both have a talk show. You have to pick which one you listen to.
Yeah.
You know, whereas this, it's a podcast. People can listen anytime. We're not doing them live. We're pre-recording them, and people can listen to them later and multiple times. And so it's because, you know, when I first started doing this, and I said I was going to reach out to all these, you know, other podcasts and help promote each other and stuff, people are like, why would you do that? They're competition. I'm like, how are they competition? Do you only listen to one podcast and no other ones?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Exactly. It's like we're all out here promoting martial arts.
And so. Different angles and just different and, you know, different people. I mean, one of the big reasons why I started this, and you've seen, because the myriad of names I've sent your way, it's like, well, he hasn't gotten to these people yet. I really want to hear him. So I just kind of got it in my head. You know what? I'm just going to try and start my own thing. And I was pretty nervous because I don't have the velvety voice as you do. And I certainly don't prepare for for the show. One of my guests, after we talked, they kind of gave me some notes about, well, I'm surprised you didn't ask me about this or ask me about that. And I'm kind of saying to myself, well, I didn't know that you did this or that. I guess I should have looked beforehand. But
yeah, and like I said, part of that's me, you know, working in radio since 1989. I've done thousands of interviews, not just martial arts ones. So it's something I've, you know, I put, as you've also, you've heard me say, you know, 4 or 5 plus hours into each episode between preparing for it and editing it and everything. So it's, you know, I probably maybe over prepared on some of them, but you know, that's,
no, it's good. It's good.
But not everyone has to do that either. You know, it's, you know, not everyone. Also, I mean, I like I said before this, I do professional voiceover. I've had a studio in my house since like 98. So, I mean, I had all the gear I needed for the most part, and I was, you know, I didn't have to go out and buy any extra stuff and whatnot. So I had a radio production studio, had a voiceover studio. So this is something that was, it was easy for me to do. You know, a lot of other people had to put a lot more into it to launch a podcast. For me, it was, you know, I currently actually do two podcasts, and like this one, before I launched the show, I had 26 episodes fully recorded, fully produced, ready to go. Before I launched my first one, I had half a year ready to go. My other podcast I do that's completely different, I had 45 episodes completely done and ready to go before I launched. So it's, and like that one right now, I have 10 episodes ahead ready to go. This one I have 5 recorded, not fully produced yet. You know, that's a lot more to go into those. So yeah, and, you know, I know people that do just do a podcast on their phone and nothing else. You know, I know other people who pay to go to a professional studio, which I'm against. I'm like, unless you're making money, don't spend money on every single episode. Me, the only thing that's cost me is time.
Yeah. You know, it's costing me some time and some equipment. It's very easy for those of you that are wanting to start a podcast, be careful. It gets very easy to start spending money on stuff that maybe you don't really need. But
that's one thing. If anyone seriously wants to look into doing it, reach out to me. I'll give you some pointers and some tips. I've helped about a dozen people launch a podcast. You don't have to spend a crap load of money. If you want to, you can, but you don't have to. I mean, I've helped people do it for as little as maybe $100, $150, you know, and I've had people spend well over $1,000 to get into it. So, you know, there's everything in between. Like I said, you can do it just on a phone. You can literally start a podcast for nothing, you know. And obviously, if you're going to go after, you know, some big names and stuff, you want it to be a little more professional. You want to put at least some money into it and have some professional gear and stuff. And but yeah, it is definitely fun. Oh, yeah. I love doing it. And as long as the guests keep saying yes, I will continue to do the show as long as I'm able to. So.
I like it. You definitely have a listener from me. I've been enjoying all the episodes and trying to go back that. through some of my favorites. And
that's the only bad thing with me is because of my schedule, I don't even get to listen to other podcasts. I used to listen to 3-4 different podcasts a day, and now all that time I spent listening to other podcasts is just working on mine. So, like, you know, maybe once or twice a month, if I'm driving more than 20 minutes, I'll actually get to listen to another podcast, but it's rare and I feel bad about it. Mm-hmm. I just don't have the time to sit down and listen to an hour podcast. And I feel horrible about it because I have a lot of friends that do them that I've never listened to or barely listened to just because of my schedule. Cause you know, I have a full-time job on top of it. I work in IT. I have, like I said, 2 podcasts that I currently do. I do professional voiceover work. That's my side hustle, and that takes a lot of time. Plus, I do professional sports announcing. I'm a stadium announcer for local sports teams. So I do that a lot. I do, you know, multiple sports at different colleges and high schools in the area and everything. And so little to no free time,
unfortunately. Oh, yeah. No.
And right now, any totally extra free relate. Time I find, I'm trying to go into the gym and start getting back into training in a more regular basis. So. And the same thing with reading books. I mean, as you've heard me say many times on my show, I used to read a book a week. And I've read like 2 books in the last year, maybe. So just because of the free time. Oh, and I'm not complaining. I mean, I miss doing that stuff, but I also love doing the podcast.
No, I'm right there with you doing multiple martial arts and then my job and then doing the podcast, and then I also wanted to get some more reading. So now having interviewed people, it's like, oh, well, I've got this book. And so then I get the book, and I've still got all these books that I need to finish and get to, and don't know where to find the time for everything, but you know, just trying to make it work as I can. So,
yeah, that's the thing. I have probably right to my right, I have a stack of about 22 books that I've either been given or bought from my guests that I haven't read, haven't had a chance to read yet. So a few of them I've started and got like a chapter in, and then I start editing again and put it aside. I'll pick it up later. Like, geez, I just got another one on Friday. I just got another book in the mail on Friday. And I'm like,
I bought a book yesterday. So my the Kenpo group that I train with, we got together the other day, and someone brought up, oh, well, we should do like a book club. And there's a, I can't think of the title right off the top of my head, but it's like, okay, well, yeah, let's do that. And so. Like, I don't really have time to read another book, but
a few of my listeners have asked me to actually publish the list of, because one of the things I asked my guests is their favorite martial arts book, and actually go and publish the list on the website. So that's another project that I'm working on. Hopefully sometime in 2025, we'll have it out there. I'd started on it about 2 years ago and actually have the spreadsheet with up to like the first 70 guests, and then I just got too busy and kind of forgot about it. So now I'll have to go back and re-listen to at least the end of like 130 episodes to get that spreadsheet going. So that's the only thing, is I don't know if I have time to do that, but I'm working on a promo video for the podcast. My instructor said he's going to let me at his next tournament set up a table or a booth. And I was just going to have like a TV with a promo video highlighting some of the most popular episodes and popular guests, you know, like Cynthia Rothrock and Tom the Dragon Wilson and things like that. So people can see that and actually see their faces and some of the movies they've done, and hopefully get more listeners that way. So always working on different ways to try to grow the show. And I joined a podcast network. That's one thing. Once your show is a little more established and you have it down to a science and consistent with your episodes, everything, something you might consider doing is joining a podcast network. It's a good way to gain more listeners.
I was meaning to talk to you about that. I noticed the kind of promo on your last few episodes. And so, yeah, we'll definitely have to talk about that.
Definitely.
And yeah, I'm just, you know, enjoying the show and looking forward to all wonderful guests that you have coming up, and just hearing the stories and learning about all these great folks is a joy for me and all your listeners, I'm sure are enjoying it as well. So,
hey, I appreciate it. Seriously, I do appreciate all the referrals, and I do plan on getting to as many of them as I can. I also have another list I'm going through, and so I probably have a list of about 50 different suggestions from listeners and guests that I need to reach out to and research and contact and try to get stuff set up with. And so, yeah.
Okay, good to know that I'm not the only one sending them to
you. Oh, no, you're not. I mean, after the first probably 30-some guests that I had, 90-some percent of them have come from referrals. A lot of them are from former guests. You know, guests like, oh, you should talk to this person. You should talk to this. You should talk to this person. So it's, I've had, one guest that has, Mr. Francis Pineda, that has probably directly or indirectly sent me at least 30 different guests. So yeah.
It's very nice.
Very, very cool. And I still have another two more that he sent me that I'm going to be hopefully interviewing in the next month or so. And it's referrals were good. It's just like kind of when I worked on radio requests, song requests from listeners. I mean, one of these radio, I had a 1-hour radio show on a station, and the station didn't think the show would do well. And it was averaging 20 requests a show for a 1-hour show. I literally couldn't get to all the requests in a 1-hour show. I never had to plan what songs I was going to play because I knew I'd play one song and I'd start getting phone calls. So it's the same type thing, and obviously, one tip I will give you is, especially when it's people you haven't heard of, is guests pitching themselves like, oh, I should be on your show. There's nothing wrong with it. And a lot of times it works out really well. But not. I've had a few where the guests have pitched themselves, and like, no, So it's I've went into martial arts message boards and say, hey, who would you people recommend? And there's always one person I would recommend myself, and usually you're looking a little more into them, like, yeah, no, little too cocky, a little too into themselves. But I've had a few that have recommended themselves; they've been good. And I had some person, hey, I heard your podcast, and I just released this book, and those are good ones, but it's just someone who's like, hey, I think you should interview me. Not necessarily who are you, but definitely get someone like that. Do some research. I highly suggest that because it could backfire. Out of my 200 plus, I have maybe honestly I probably have two interviews I wish I went to published. But at the time, I had to, or I would have missed a week. I wasn't ready with another episode, and by the time I finished editing it, I'm like, man, this person wasn't a good interview. And I've had two out of over 200, so that's not bad.
that's pretty good.
And one was very, very, very early on, and part of it was probably me not finding my complete groove yet, maybe. Like I said, I just two off the top of my head where like the guests just weren't good guests. So one that didn't feel like they just wanted to be there, and another one that was only there to sell something. And that's the only reason they were there. So, I would definitely give that bit of a warning for guests. So it's try to find, if you've never heard of them, try to find other interviews they've done and see how they do and stuff. And
Gotcha.
Because that's a big part of it. Because some people just are not good at interviewing.
Yeah.
And some people who are the most worried about it and don't think they're good at interviewing turn into the best interviews. So.
No, I can definitely relate to that. It's definitely been some that when we started off, I thought, this is probably not going to work out so well. And then we just hit that right topic or that right spot in their journey, and then things just really picked up from there, and we could have kept going, and I had to use some restraint and be like, okay, no, we got to cut this off here.
Yep.
We're going to be talking for 10 hours. So.
Oh, yeah. Well, I had one that went 2.5 hours. I edited it down to 1 hour 45. It was a great interview, but he just loved to talk, and which is fine. That's, you want that. You want people to love to talk, but it was like, all right, I think we might need to wrap it up here because this is going to take me 10 hours to edit this dang thing. So, you know, and two other funny ones, two of my favorite guests, you know, Don Wilson and Anthony DeLongish. Phenomenal guests. Both of them, they wanted to talk to me before we did the interview. They're like, let's set up a phone call and whatever. And I think Don, we ended up talking for almost 90 minutes. I'm like, realize, Don, we could have just recorded this whole conversation and been done. He's like, yeah, we probably could have. And Anthony was the same way. I talked to Anthony on the phone, and we talked almost 2 hours. like yep. We could have literally just recorded these phone calls. And I should have. When they said they wanted to do a phone call, and now anytime anyone asks me that, I'll like, yeah, that's fine. Let's do that. And I'll actually just patch into my stuff and record the phone call just in case, because it could end up being the full interview. Hasn't happened yet, but at least I'm prepared. So,
I've definitely had a couple of people like that, and I'm gonna have to start getting prepared for that sort of situation. So.
Nice. I think Larry, we talked for 15 minutes beforehand, and then we did the interview the next day. So, he'll be a fun one. You'll enjoy talking to Larry. I think he's a really fun interview. Super nice guy.
Yeah, I'm very 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 much looking forward to that. All right, so we're going to, just like with talking about the guest, I mean, I could talk to you for days on end, and we'll definitely have to do multiple parts in the future. But we're going to go ahead and move to our lightning round here, so we can close in on wrapping up. I'm jealous. Not really sure the word I want to use. I guess I'll say jealous, and but I've restrained myself from stealing all of your wrap up questions, because you have just the best ones. But we'll stick to mine, and we'll do yours maybe at another time. But
all right.
So my first question is: do you have a favorite technique? And we don't have to limit this to Kenpo, since you've done other
probably
other
not a things. Favorite technique, but I literally just talked about this yesterday because a friend was retesting for their 4-3 black belt, and I was talking with another master who I hadn't seen in a while, and talking about how over the years my favorite kick has changed, and for many years, from probably 95 through probably about 2010, it was a technique we have in Taekwondo called a jump spinning knife foot kick. And that was just, it was my favorite kick. And it's supposed to be lightning round, but a really quick, funny story about that. When I was at a school in California, when I was training out there, and one of the assistant instructors was doing a private lesson with me, and two young gentlemen came in to watch the lesson. And she was talking to them. They're like, well, we're deciding between this and a Taekwondo school. And she kind of immediately started insulting Taekwondo. And she's like, well, Taekwondo and not really good for, real stuff like, Kenpo is and blah, blah. Like, look at this gentleman. He's done Taekwondo for a while. And she holds up her hand. She goes, show me your best kick. And I'm like, well, can you please get a pad, ma'am? She's like, no. I'm like, just humor me. So she goes and gets a hand target. And I did my jump spinning knife foot, and the pad like flew off her hand. And she's like, God damn, and shakes her hand. And the kids got up and walked out. So, which was kind of funny. But and I think just getting older, and because of my knees and stuff, not being able to maybe jump as high, it switched to a jump turning side kick. And that's been my favorite one for probably the last 10 to 15 years. I love that kick. I've done breaks with it. It's one of my most powerful kicks. So that's definitely my favorite one. So
nice. Yeah, I like that. Very nice. Right. Next question. Do you have a favorite form and or set? We won't limit this to Kenpo.
I don't like form. I've never been a pattern fan. It's when I test, it's my least favorite. I mean, as far as to watch, I know it's not an actual form. It's a combination of a couple, but the, as you know, the opening sequence on The Perfect Weapon with Jeff in the hotel room to the song "The Power" by Snap. Mm-hmm. I love that. I know it's like a combination of, I think, two or three different forms in Kenpo, if I remember correctly. But
yes,
that's my favorite one to watch, probably. Beyond that is one of my favorite ones I've ever seen on stage. Was one of my former guests, Carmichael Simon, was watching him compete when he was like 15 or 16 years old at the Diamond Nationals. And this was right around 93, 94 is when The Crow came out. Mm-hmm. And he did a form and he came out dressed as The Crow. He had the white face and that hair hanging in his eyes and did these flips and everything. And I don't remember what form it was. I know he talked about it on my show, but that was cool to see live. So probably those two are my favorite.
Very nice. I like it. I'm pretty sure I know the answer to this one, but I will ask it. Do you have a favorite weapon?
Yeah, as I've mentioned many times, Tonfa. And that's another one that's changed. It used to be Nunchuck. Nunchuck used to be my favorite. But I don't know why. I like Tonfa. It's personally, because it's actually saved my butt a couple times in real life. So
that's a pretty good reason.
Yeah, yeah. But I still love Nunchuck. I still train with Nunchuck. I still like Bo Staff. But yeah, Tonfa.
Very nice. I like it. All right. If there is anyone that you could train with, living or dead, besides Ed Parker, who would that be? And we can include people that you've already trained with or...
I mean, obviously, off the top of my head, the first one is Bruce Lee. I mean, just to spend a day. Even in job interviews, I had people, if you could have lunch with someone alive or dead, Bruce Lee, first one I always say. So just to spend a day training with him would be really, really, really cool. I mean, that'd be fun.
Very nice. Yeah. Very nice.
Other than him, the other one is someone I've only trained with once is my instructor, Grandmaster Myung Yun. I've had I've trained with him twice, but that was both in a class. So to actually train with him as like a one-on-one thing, you know, back in his prime 20, 30 years ago would have been amazing too. So, but yeah.
I like it. That's a good one. So the second part of that question, same thing, but this would be fictional characters.
Mr. Miyagi, hands down.
There you go. I like it.
I mean, he's on my Mount Rushmore. He's I tell people he's my first instructor unofficially. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't think my real first instructor Bill likes that, but you know, yeah, Mr. Miyagi, he's the reason I got into it. So definitely.
Very nice. I like it. All right. So now we are at the point for a shameless self-promotion. So you can plug anything you like or anything else that you wanted to get out there before we close out. You have the floor. And
all right. Well, definitely invite people to check out the podcast. They can, any podcast app, it should be on there, called Everyday Martial Artist. They can also go to the website, everydaymartialartist.com. And there's contact info on there. If you want to recommend guests or ask questions, feel free. And the other one I know has nothing to do with martial arts, but I mentioned I have a second podcast. This is completely a different part of my life, and anyone out there who maybe is a music fan and enjoys a cappella music, I have a podcast called Uncovered A Cappella. Every Wednesday it's a new episode, and it's three original a cappella songs from three different artists. I've been doing that longer than I've been doing the martial arts one, actually.
I have to check that out.
Is that a completely different part of my life? I got into a cappella music in the early 90s also, and I own over 4,000 a cappella CDs. One thing on that is it's under the name Brian Michaels, because that's the name I used in radio way back when, and so that's how people in the a cappella world knew me. If people listen and like, well, that's not the same guy. No, it is. It's just a different part of my life, and that's how that community knows me as Brian Michaels. But yeah, Uncovered, and that's actually uncoveredpod.org, and that one you can't find on as many apps, unfortunately, because of copyright issues. Even though I have permission from every group I play on my show to play their songs, some of the apps like Spotify, doesn't matter, they will not let you play them. Because they don't realize it. Their AI system thinks that you're playing someone else's music, even though I literally have permission from over 150 groups to play their original songs that they own the rights to. There's no record labels involved. And so, yeah, but if you like that kind of music, it's a short one. It's anywhere from like 8 minutes to 15 minutes every week. So it's, other than two episodes I did interviews on, my 100th and my 200th episode,
those
are kind of the two things I have going. And like I said, the martial arts one definitely takes up more of the time, and I put a lot more into, but they're both passion projects for me. So
excellent. Well, I can't thank you enough for not only being on the show with me, but giving me the inspiration and the helpful tips for starting starting this show. There's so many things that I took your advice on as far as doing this that have helped tremendously. So I can't thank you enough for being on and for all your help and everybody get out there and listen to his show. And if you're still needing some other stuff to listen to, then you can listen to this show.
Well, definitely listen to Reggie's show. Come on. I mean, I'm so proud that you did this, and I appreciate that you reached out to me for help with it. And hopefully I'll be talking to you on your 200th episode, man, in a couple of years. That'd be kind of cool. I mean, definitely keep it up and keep, like I said, the main thing is you got to enjoy it. As long as you're still having fun, keep doing it.
Oh yeah. So, no, I'm having so much fun. The editing is well, when I do editing, I like to joke that the only thing that hits the cutting room floor are the soles of my feet. So,
I'm the opposite. I love editing, but I also, like I said, I've been doing it for 40 years. So I love editing audio, and that's one thing I definitely take the pride in. And even when I worked in radio, I want it to sound good. And I've had many of my guests tell me that it's the best sounding podcast I've ever been on, which I take pride in that. And that's something I take seriously. And you know, but a lot of people don't have 5 hours of free time to edit a podcast. So
exactly.
That's the thing. It's all good.
All right. Well, yes. Thank you again. And I can't wait to get this out for everyone to hear. I will let you know when I have it ready to go. But thank you so much. And we will talk soon.
All right. I appreciate it, Reggie. Keep up the good work.
All right. Thank you. Thank you for listening to My Empty Hands. If you enjoyed the show, please share it with a friend. If you didn't enjoy it, please share it with an enemy. If you'd like to be a guest, or if you would like to recommend a guest for the show, please email me at podcast@talkingkenpo.com. Thank you.